Hello and welcome to our session today. Very exciting and great to see so many people here risking our lovely Melbourne weather. We have Barry Jones here with us today, which is very exciting. I'm Jill Singer. And Barry, I'm not going to bother introducing in any extensive manner because you know him. Suffice to say, Barry is a man who knows a heck of a lot, but not about sport or about popular culture. So if that's your thing, sorry, not today.
Or 14th century Islamic tiles.
I bet that's actually not true. I bet you do know something about 14th century.
13th century.
Ah, we found the weak spot, haven't we there, Barry? So we're actually talking about life and wisdom and... we're talking about ageing and where we're at in this. We look at different stages in life. I wonder which has been the most satisfying stage of your life so far.
Well, you know, it certainly wasn't the political period. Mm. I can see now... No, I mean, when I look back, if I were to add up the things that were satisfactory and that I felt gratified by... I think the political thing, which went on really far too long, I think maybe about a third of it was productive, but a lot of it was not. A lot of it was absolutely frustrating as I was trying to get ideas across and so on, and people would always say, well, not now, not now. These are subjects that we dealt with at some later stage. Problem about often in politics is that decisions are being made on the basis of, well... as we know with the 24-hour media cycle, we're used to that now. It was pretty bad even then back in the 1980s because they'd say, look, that's all very well about talking about the ageing of the population, but we've got a budget to get through next week and we've got to look at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 short-term measures that we've got to put in the budget and we want all the support that we can and we want you to just sit there stumm and don't complain if science funding gets cut a bit. And that was part of the problem.
Like, but Julie Bishop is meant to sit there and not roll her eyes if foreign aid is cut.
Absolutely. That's typically the way it happens. My problem, I think, was that I kept raising issues about 20 or 25 years before they became obvious. I mean, I kept trying to talk to them about the social impact, for example, of the IT revolution, the information technology revolution. And they said, well, yes.
That's with Sleeper's Wake.
Well, very much in Sleeper's Wake. Mm. And they said, well, yes, that's all very interesting, but look, come back to us some other time, but not now. You know, and I when I think back... I started raising the issue of climate change in 1984. Mm. And that's over that 31-year period. It's just been intensely frustrating because you never found... I'd talk to a Prime Minister, I'd talk to Hawke, and after a few minutes you could see that his attention was wandering and you knew that he'd lost it or that he didn't understand it. And he'd say, oh, well, look, you know, come back some other time. But I really am very busy right now. So the result is that those long-term issues that you had to look at, including the issues of ageing, were always something where you can say, you can put that off. You know, I remember somebody once said, you know, in politics, the urgent always displaces the important. Mm-hmm. So the result was that those really major issues, like the implications of ageing and so on, for example, or climate change, or dealing with our long-term incapacity to deal with some of the very critical issues in our region or, indeed, in the Middle East, they're always issues that are postponed. And I think in some ways the most... I'm sorry, long-winded answer to the question, but you were talking about, in some ways, I'd say the last 25 years have probably been as productive as any that I've had, and when I've been
getting
mostly
out
outside traditional work.
Philip Adams did say he thinks that you devoted far too much of your life to the Labor Party.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. Mm. And the problem is, as I wrote recently, this is an era of... It's a curious era in politics because we diverge on trivia, that a lot of that toxic politics, which is highly personal, but isn't about anything of substance. But if you look at the absolute major issues, and I mean very serious issues like, say, the problem of refugees, or how you deal with the jihadism, for example, you've got a degree of convergence. And I wrote in The Conversation a week or two ago to say that in Australian politics at the moment, the Labor Party and the Coalition are essentially two wings of the same bird. Because in the end, when it comes to a critical issue, Labor says, I think one side, I won't say which is which, one side lies and the other side is cowardly.
It doesn't matter which is which, really.
It doesn't matter which is which. You toss your coin. So that it's very difficult to say, well, I can look back and I can say I'm a proud member of... In fact, I've got a life membership and I've whited out the word proud. I can say I'm a member. But I wouldn't describe myself as a proud member unless you use the word proud as in proud flesh.
Something that can be cut off.
Yeah.
One important issue that we do see broadly bipartisan support for is objection to the death penalty, which is fortunate.
Yep.
That we do see this at least in politics at the moment, which has been an issue that's been very important to you. Unfortunately, we haven't seen that same level of cooperation with things like asylum seekers. But certainly with the death penalty as it stands, we have seen, I think, a fairly admirable response put up by Australia to the situation at the moment in Indonesia.
Well, I think that's largely true. I mean, I'm certainly in the case of Sukumaran and Chan, the government, I think, has been pretty good. I don't say effective, but I think Julie Bishop's been good. Prime Minister, I think, less successful in this area.
Less good.
But we run the risk of being monumentally hypocritical in this area, because when it came to the Bali bombers years ago, it was clear that John Howard was in favour of the executions.
Yes.
And in the case of... And Rudd was in favour of the executions. Simon Crean was, you know, very equivocal about it all. Mark Latham was in favour of the execution. Now, there are two or three problems. One is, of course, that with these death penalty cases, you either take a view of absolute objection to it on moral principle, and that means that easy cases and hard cases both have to be rejected. And you might say, well, in the scale of things, what the Bali bombers did was a completely different order of magnitude to what the Bali Nine, the drug smugglers, did. I understand that. But if you're taking a principled position, then you have to oppose it right across the board. And our difficulty is that if we say to the Indonesians, look, we have a particular objection. We have a particular objection to the execution of Australian citizens.
Yes.
Not saying anything about the others, about Australian citizens. But on the other hand, if people are being executed because of what they've done to Australian citizens, well, that's all right.
It goes around and around, though, doesn't it, Barry, too, because then Indonesia will say, well, we don't like it happening to our citizens in another country. So, you know, everyone's hypocritical.
Well, they're monumentally hypocritical as well.
Yes.
Because they say, oh, when you're challenging the way we run things, and this is an abrogation or an attempt to diminish the authority of our law. But on the other hand, they don't mind hopping in to Saudi Arabia if Saudi Arabia's got Indonesians on death row.
Oh, absolutely. What I'm wondering, Barry, you sit with the it's just wrong. killing people is wrong.
Well, I've been taking this... Well, if you go back, there's the in many ways, the person who's the most influential thinker about it is Montaigne. And going back, that's exactly at the time of Shakespeare. And he'd been a magistrate and he'd been involved in law enforcement. And if you read Montaigne's essays, he's constantly referring to the death penalty and that he's opposed to it under any circumstances, whatever. And it's a subject that I've worked on, you know, for a very long time. And I suppose if I had to pick out one particular moment of gratification, it would have been working with Dick Hamer when I was still in the State Parliament, getting the death penalty abolished. But I just mentioned something that stuck in my mind. When Malcolm Fraser launched did the Melbourne launch of my autobiography, A Thinking Read, and he spoke about the death penalty then. Now, there's a certain amount of hagiography about Malcolm since he died. Most of it justified, I think. I think he developed as a human being after he left the Parliament in quite a remarkable way. But it was interesting that, you see, he always used to say, I haven't changed, the whole political process has changed. But he did change. And if you go back to 1973, when Whitlam abolished the death penalty federally, Malcolm Fraser voted against it. He voted to retain the death penalty. But it was curious, when he did the Melbourne launch of my book, the most powerful part of it was when he read from the chapter on the death penalty, and in particular read that section that Tolstoy wrote when he saw an execution in Paris. And Malcolm was at his... was just extraordinary on that. So you could see that he was an example of somebody who over a period had thought about the issue, rethought about the issue, and suddenly had gone from somebody who supported it, perhaps not with great enthusiasm, but becoming a strong opponent.
Very few people have the courage to change their minds, do they?
And yet it's part of the whole process of maturation. And that's, I suppose, one of the reasons why I'm grateful to whoever runs the show, the fact that I've had, you know, well, the fact that I've had, you know, several additional decades of life in which I can do things, in which I can understand things more than I would have understood them before. I mean, I'm very conscious, because I did this stuff on the third age, that is the age that I imagine a certain proportion of our audience today are in, people who are post-retirement age, but who are still active, who are still communicating, who are still
not quite
making
dead.
A significant... Well, no, far from it. No, and And anyway, after I left the Parliament, I went off to Cambridge to work for a couple of years at Trinity College on the whole question of what we call the third age. And, of course, you're all familiar with the third age, the universities of the third age. But the idea where you've got to have a heavy emphasis in public policy to keeping people active, keeping them fit, keeping them mentally alert, staving off Alzheimer's and other degenerative diseases. And, I mean, my ambition's always been to spend the longest period I can in the third age and the shortest possible period in the fourth age. I think about 10... I think about 10 minutes would be too long.
How do you know when the fourth age is hit, when you're not productive?
Oh, you know when it's hit when you don't want to get out of bed.
Ah, OK. Yeah. So it's just you're not productive or caring.
And you no longer know, and you don't care anymore, and your processes start to shut down.
I interviewed you once where you... it was soon after the release of A Thinking Read.
Yes, yes.
And you said then that you saw no reason why you wouldn't live to 120. And I wonder, do you still want to?
Did I say 120? I said I think the line I used to take was to say that
It could have been more.
Oh, no, but if I was looking back on my family history and I realised that, I mean, it's astonishing to me to think that I'm older than Queen Victoria was when she died, that I'm older than Tolstoy was when he died. And that if you go back through my family history on the male line, I'm far and away the longest lived male in that sequence going back to, well, I mean, somewhere along the line you come to Methuselah, so that's a bit of a blip, but... But you,
was that
you,
700 or 900 years?
969.
969.
But it means that I would have thought the prospect of reaching the centenary was extremely remote, absolutely, given my family history. But in fact, if I look at the way I feel at the age of 82, I think, can I do another 18 years? Well, I don't know, maybe, but I could imagine it happening. I mean, what... Joe Hockey said, which was derided, where he said he could imagine that people would live, you know, that you might have people living to the age of 150. That's not as far-fetched as it sounds. I mean, because of my interest in demography, there's an interesting example of a woman called Jean Calment, C-A-L-M-E-N-T. If you look her up on YouTube, you'll see her actually talking and singing. And she was born in 1875, and she lived on to the age of 124. Mm. And she was in not bad nick right until the age of 124. And the curious thing about it, I don't know what lesson you can draw from this, was she never worked. She was always a kept woman. She never worked. And she smoked until the end of her life.
She was, I think she was a woman that said you should avoid men if you want a long life.
Well,
I think she did.
Well, of course, she was remarkable because she was involved in this very complicated process called a tontine, where somebody invested in this house, somebody who was much younger than she was, invested in this house, and for some reason she paid him a nominal rent. And he thought, oh, well, it's absolutely... Of course, she's 50 years older than me. She'll have to die long before me and I'll get the advance. Well, in fact...
That would keep you going.
Yeah.
It would indeed. Okay. What would you... I was going to talk about legacy... but we know what your legacy is going to be, Barry. We know very well. You've had so many gongs and awards. You're greatly loved. It's there. I wonder if you get any sense at any time. I know Simone de Beauvoir, for example, when she was writing, when she was older, she said, I've done all this work now, and what I do from now on is essentially adding to that, that the body of work is done and the majority is all said and done. Do you find that now a challenge for you in terms of what you intellectually explore from now on?
Well, no. I'm finishing this book. In fact, my great hope is that I'll do the finish sometime before the end of this week. It's just possible. I've called it a shock of recognition. And it's really about trying to encourage people to take on reading and listening to music that they think, oh, it might be beyond me, it might be too difficult, I don't think I'd react properly, and so they put it off or just don't do it. And I noticed with my own reading that, for example, when I was going through it, I thought, will I or won't I include Dante's Divine Comedy? And because I'd read one volume donkeys years ago, or back decades and decades ago, and then I'd sort of, one of those things I'd postponed. And then Clive James did his, what I think is a, if I may say, a slightly unfortunate translation of the comedy. And I thought, oh, no, it's a bit gutless. I really ought to embrace it. Well, I leapt into it. And I think for about 3 months I became a kind of Dante boy, you see, because everyone
Gosh,
was in
no.
reach. It's amazing. It's amazing you weren't a president. Anyone within reach was likely to get an earful about Dante. Because when I was going through it, I found it absolutely magical. Mm. It's so extraordinary. And for those of you who are taking notes, well, I hope some of you are. For those of you who are taking notes, I think the easiest, the best version to get is a version by a husband and wife team called Hollander. Hollander, very easy to get to. But they've got the Italian text on one side and the English translation on the other. The reason I mention that is that, and even better if you get or on YouTube or get on disc some of the readings in Italian, because it's the sheer musicality of the Latin and the particular form in which it's put, these three-line verses, tercets, three-line verses and so on, but with the internal rhymes and internal rhythms inside each third line. That's so fascinating. And when you read it, it is hair-raising. But wonderfully, just wonderful. And I think, well, you know, I'm glad I persisted with that. Hadn't intended to. And then I sort of stumbled across it. And I thought, this is something absolutely quite extraordinary. And you get a sense of a world, I mean, a medieval world, that's so remote from us, so remote from our experience. But you might say, you might draw some parallel that with the present anxieties about what's happening in the Middle East with jihadism and so on, where you get a closed view of the world, that's not the world of modernity and not the world of science and not the world of critical scientific analysis.
Barry, your passion, I know your passion, is to try and get other people to feel the passion you have, that you get from art and culture, the incredible fire that is lit in you when you see something and the shock of the recognition. And it's that sharing of culture, the sharing of understanding, it's the link of humanity that stretches throughout all history and puts us there. One thing we don't hear you talk about is romantic love and that passion. And I wonder, I've heard people talk about this incredible communication and love of humanity that you have, but I wonder emotionally if that might be an area for you that still remains a little unexplored.
I think it's probably a valid comment. It may be that I don't do intimacy, that I do the sort of the more public expression. There's probably some validity in that.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, if I could understand it, I would have done something about overcoming it. I don't particularly understand. But I suppose what's happened is that after a while, you develop a particular modus operandi, as we say in the Labor Party, and you operate in a particular way and you think, well, am I functioning properly? Am I doing things? And in some ways, what I've tended to do is that the realm of the private remains just that. It may be a very valid criticism that I don't do intimacy particularly well, and that it's certainly been a practice of mine. Well, it's developed as a practice of mine, but it's an area that I haven't really explored enough, and it's certainly not an area that I talk about.
No. it's an unusual one. How does the not the great strength in intimate relationships reflected, say, with your friendships? I know it's... when you talk with your friends, is it always about these wonderful, wonderful things about the human spirit and what it can achieve and what we know? I wonder... I've often seen men that get together and they've known each other for years and they actually don't know how many children the other person has, or how their wife is going, or any of this. And I wonder how good are you with your friends at keeping up on these sorts of things? Like, how are you doing this sort of stuff?
Well, I make lists. I make lists and I'll say, you know, make sure that I ask about. So from that, but I mean, frankly, that's a skill perhaps that you also develop in politics as well. That you say, when you go into the room, make sure you find out, and then there's a whole series of questions that you need to know. So that if you know that there's somebody there who's perhaps had a bereavement or that who's... child has achieved something or other, then you want to make sure that you mention it.
Oh, it can be useful caring about people.
And then you... Well, I'm not completely uncaring about people. For what it's worth, and I don't want to pursue this too far, but I think I am... No, it's not for me to judge. I was going to say, I think I'm a good friend, and I think where I've probably been most effective and helpful has been when people are on the point of making an exit from life. Where I've been, I think I've been caring, and I think I've been caring and helpful and so on. So that in a sense, I'm not. I'm not totally self-absorbed or completely absorbed with, you know, great subjects. I am.
Have you ever been consumed by love?
If I was, it would involve third parties, and I'm not going to involve them. I mean, unless you're yes. The alternative is...
I'm not asking out of a prurient interest. It's as you're a man of such great passions intellectually. And for all of us, we always know throughout history people can be brought undone by some of their more heated passions of the flesh, all of these things. But it's also that incredible bond that people can have. And I just wonder how much that might have pushed and pulled you on the path.
I think to a large extent, although perhaps I might be getting undone today, that there has been a dichotomy between the public life and the private. Well, the life of the mind, I suppose, and then the public life, and then the private life. And the private life really does remain just that.
Oh, Barry, I love the way when you clap, he just gives me this little look like, there, yours. Back off, lady. Okay, look, I'm happy to back off on that. It's something I've often wanted to talk with you about. Children, can we talk about children?
That's a very short subject of conversation.
No. I know, I can hear some people say, well, look, you know, this might be uncomfortable. Happen to love Barry very much.
I
think he's a very interesting man, and I like hearing about all aspects of him, so I'm not trying to be intrusive or distressing for you at all, and Barry understands that.
Well, to my knowledge, I've never had any children. my late first wife, for a whole collection of reasons which I have no intention of going into, had made a very firm decision on that, and I was not going to push it. It was not for me to take the sort of strong 19th century Victorian husband position and say, you will have children if I want it. That was to be her decision, and I went along with it.
I wonder, you know, all of us, when we get older, we start thinking, oh, what might I have done differently? I know, for example, I wanted to have lots of children, and I had one. Life never turns out the way you expect it to. I know some of your friends just think, you would make the most wonderful father. You've, in a sense, been a father to many Australians in a way. But also I wonder how much we invest in this idea of what's important in family. I mean, I think, you know, your choices are entirely valid and wonderful and you've lived a fantastic life. I wonder, though, when you reflect on it, how you might feel about those things now.
Well, look, it's kind of to suggest that I might have been a very good father, but I might have, in fact, been a very bad father. Part of the problem is, I think if you're a politician, particularly if you're a federal politician, there's a better than even chance that you'll be a disastrous father.
Yes,
and you really have to make that choice. Do I really want to be part of the national process going up to Canberra, leading this completely artificial life? And the truth is, I said, yes, I do. I'm not saying it worked out as I would have hoped, but yes, I do. And I did it. And I was a minister. I tried my best. And then, so as to whether I'd have been an effective father, but because what is certain, I'd have been an absentee father.
I know. I don't know how any successful politician really manages to negotiate a successful family life when you look at the pressures on them.
Infinitely easier if you stay in the state.
Yes. Yeah. State-based, obviously. Barry, I know you're very influenced by the Stendahl syndrome that people might have heard about, that was originally described when people would visit Florence. I think it was called the Florence syndrome. And it's where you become actually overtaken and overwhelmed. Your senses are overwhelmed, by beauty and recognition of things and connections. What I'm trying to get at when I'm talking with you there is whether that kind of intense response can be triggered by people as well as by what they've produced in terms of cultural output. I mean the direct relationship as opposed to what they've produced.
Just going back, Stendahl syndrome is named for the great French novelist Stendhal, who wrote Scarlet and Black and The Charterhouse of Parma. And he, at one stage, went to Florence to see the Church of Santa Croce. And Santa Croce is a church with its extraordinary architecture, but it also has the tombs of Michelangelo, of Machiavelli, of Rossini, but it also has an empty tomb because they're hoping that one day Dante's remains will be brought from Ravenna, where he died, back to Florence. Anyway, when he went there on this particular occasion, he was conscious of getting the shakes, you know, that his knees were trembling and the pattern of his breathing changed and so on. And the psychologists now call it Stendahl syndrome, or sometimes the Florence syndrome. Well, I must confess to being a sufferer from this condition.
Enjoy it.
And well, it's sometimes enjoyable, sometimes painful. And often I don't quite know when it happens. I mean, it's often by exposure. It's often by exposure to nature, where you see something absolutely extraordinary, like Machu Picchu, for example, in Peru. Or Iguazu Falls between Argentina and Brazil. If you haven't been, you simply cannot grasp how extraordinary it is, and that when you see it, you're very likely to express to exactly have the same reaction that is simply an overwhelming feeling. But I remember some years ago, sometimes there can be that personal recollection. I remember going to, I hadn't been to Winchester Cathedral for a long time. this is not the performing group, but the building. I hadn't been to Winchester Cathedral, and I hadn't been there for probably 30 years, and I'd been there with my late first wife, and that may have triggered it off. And I just found myself absolutely overcome by it. So it was a combination of the architecture, the history, and no doubt, you know, personal contacts. And it was quite extraordinary. But on the whole, I would say it's a collectivity of things. It's no one thing. It's where you've got a convergence of a physical location, of a sense of time, a sense of history, a sense of tradition, but also the role of people, that you see a landscape or like Machu Picchu and you think of birds and animals and so on operating, the symbiosis between them. It is an overwhelming feeling, and I'm grateful for it, and I think a lot of people do experience it, but don't really pick it up.
It is extraordinary, isn't it, the physical response you can have to these sorts of things. Like we talk about the tingle down our spine from music, a physiological response to emotion like that, pleasure, interpreting like that your body actually does that. So this is an extension of that tingling, in a way. It has that intense physical emotion. Is it like an orgasm without sex?
Yes, I think it is, from what I can remember of orgasms. That's a kind of a heritage memory. I tell you, I think the most recent time, and I've just...
Heritage memory, I love that one.
Another thing to put down on your list. In Berlin, Simon Rattle, who conducts the Berlin Philharmonic, has had the American director, Peter Sellars, not the goon person, Sellars, to do these, in effect, dramatisations of the St John Passion of Bach and the St Matthew Passion of Bach. And so semi-staged. But the acting, the combination of the music, the acting, the role of the choir is devastating. Mm. Now, it's very complicated, but you can download excerpts from it on YouTube. If you look up Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, St. John Passion, Rattle, Sellars, you'll get a bit. Strangely, Berlin Philharmonic got their own DVD label. And they've got an exclusive with a joint called Fish Fine Music in Sydney. And you can't get it directly from, say, Thomas's here. You've got to go, but you can download bits of it and you'll get a sense of it. And have you ever heard this English tenor called Mark Padmore?
No.
He's the evangelist in it. He's absolutely extraordinary. But the power of it, and it is just riveting. Got to get it.
Got to get it. Got to get it. Barry, we've got a few more minutes before we throw things open to questions. And I think we should bring it back to sort of some of the drier political things about what governments can do regarding productivity, ageing, and healthcare. I know these are really big issues. I read an article yesterday, though, a study had been done in the UK where all this stuff about life expectancy was turned on its head, really, particularly for people of the boomer generation, that what they're actually finding now, some of those advances are reversing.
Yep.
And I don't know, we haven't seen any data from Australia on that, but we're assuming that there would be similar factors, I imagine. In fact... A lot of our excesses in the boomers' youth appears to be catching up with them when they're older, which might be a factor in people not living as long. But I do wonder, here, all we're talking about in politics is reducing pensions and the inequity, the potential inequity that I see as we're lining up. We know that Australian women have got 40% less in superannuation than men. Mm. Now, if these rules are changed, they're not changed, you know, according to individual differences like that. Mm. We're just out in the cold if we don't have the super and you know. It's quite astonishing what is being planned for us, I think.
Well, but the great problem, and it covers the issues you've mentioned and some of the other issues I'd bring up as well, is we've moved away from an evidentiary base. Mm. That we don't examine evidence and weigh it up and so on. If you take, for example, I mean, I found it quite inconceivable that in the intergenerational report, in his preface, Joe Hockey introduces the intergenerational report and says there's a budgetary pattern, there's a gap between revenue and expenditure, true, and that can be dealt with in only two ways, he said. One is cutting expenditure. Number two is borrowing from overseas. Mm. Full stop. Mm. But hang on, there is a third way, and it's called raising appropriate revenue levels.
Yeah.
And adjusting appropriately and getting rid of tax rorts and all the rest of it. But the curious thing is, it's not in his thinking.
No.
Or as
but
we,
I think the public pressure is pushing that now.
Well, I hope so. But you see, you've got to have an evidentiary basis. I mean, even with the appalling asylum seekers thing, you say, how big a problem is it? Is it a massive problem or is it a comparatively minor problem in terms of numbers? I mean, if you look at the number of people who've been received, if that's the word, on Lampedusa, a single small island in the Mediterranean, and then compare it with our numbers, our problems just aren't problems like that. They're problems like this. But politically, we say, oh, it's enormous. And if we did anything humanitarian in this area, well, you know, it would be the whole political system would be destroyed.
It's all up to the politicians, too, to sell this, isn't it? I remember when we had the refugees from on the short-term stay from Kosovo.
Yeah,
and Jeff Kennett was up there, and all the news reports were, you know, of women getting out and welcoming them and giving them soup and crusty bread, and all the news stories were nice and positive, and everyone was fine about it. Everyone was. And all you need is the leadership to say, it's not going to hurt you, it's fine, we can afford to be generous.
Well, you know, it's curious. A number of them were resettled temporarily in Tasmania. Mm. I mean, they don't call it Van Diemen's Land anymore, but in Tasmania. And the curious thing is, what has come out of the, you know, the various polling surveys has been that of all the places in Australia, the one with the least antagonism to refugees is Tasmania. Mm. Because we say, oh, yeah, we remember when they used to go to the local school. We remember when you had people from Kosovo who were around. Oh, yeah, that was all right. And in fact, you see, they've been demonised to such an extent, and where one party's demonising them and the other party is too craven to tackle it, because they say, oh, it'll be a vote loser in a number of areas. Funnily enough, not in Victoria, but it's thought that in Western Australia and New South Wales, Queensland, New South Wales partly largely because of the shock jocks, not in South Australia. There's a very significant difference. Here in Victoria, you can see that there's a significantly higher degree of sympathy for refugees than there is in a number of the other states. But Tasmania is actually the best of all because they simply say, well, our own experience is...
And they want people there. They need people there and to grow things, to grow the economy, and very welcoming.
But the other problem is, you see, there was another thing that Joe Hockey said that I thought was significant. It was a kind of a... you know, Descartes, the philosopher, used to say, cogito ergo sum. You know, I think, therefore I am. And you see, Joe Hockey's version is, I shop, therefore I am. You know, that that the major characteristic of human beings is their shopping capacity.
What's I shop in Latin?
And but it's, you see, this is the whole idea that you define human beings as homo economicus.
Yes. Yeah.
Economic man. That's all there is. And the other values, the values we've been talking about, you say, well, how do you weigh that up? How do you measure that? And you see, if you try to do something serious about climate change, you say, God, that's going to be pretty bad for the coal companies, and boy, they're having a hard enough time at the moment. And it's going to be hard enough for the minerals industry. We don't want to make any further burdens for them. So the result is that the whole idea of talking about what you're really trying to take a longer-term view, when you're talking about the impact of something that won't, the serious impact of which won't be felt this year or next year or the year after, but it might be 20, 30, 40 years. But the other thing to which I've neglected to mention what you were saying, you're quite right to indicate that there are some worrying indications, but they're class-based. Mm. They're class-based, that certain categories of people, many of them in the lower SES areas, are suffering from obesity, big time, are suffering from, and who are afflicted by diabetes. A lot of them are afflicted by binge drinking. Mm. A lot of them are going to be afflicted by drug usage and so on. But in effect, these are not characteristics that you find in the leafy glades of Kew and Hawthorne, but you do find it in Thomastown and Campbelltown and areas like that where they do it tough already and where you don't have, you'd have to say, some of the things that we associate, they don't have a Wheeler Centre out there.
Well, but this will be online.
Well, I hope so.
We are democratising things through the internet, in a way. We're going to take questions now, so we have some roving microphones. Anyone? We have a gentleman here halfway up with his hand up, if we can go here.
Hi. There were basically two challenges between Hawke and Keating, and I heard from Graham Richardson that basically by the end of those two challenges, pretty much everyone in the room was in tears. Can you remember what they were like?
Yes.
Were there tears?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It was very, very... No, it was a very tense period. And the... But it was also... It was also a tragic period. The way in which I view it, I thought I was asked for a yes and no answer, but I think Hawke does deserve the credit for actually being the initiator of the significant economic changes in the 1980s. That's largely because he'd had very extensive overseas experience and he was aware of what was happening in the global economy. Keating, curiously, was fairly late. He wasn't the first person in the cart, but once he was in it, it didn't take very long. He's a very quick learner. Mm. Before he started to feel that, having resisted it at first, he then wanted to push it and wanted to push it even further. And where there was a falling out, tremendous falling out with him, was that Hawke didn't want the change to happen too rapidly, because he thought if it happened too rapidly, then there'd be a destabilisation within society as a whole. And in the end, it was very tragic what happened, because they both made an extraordinary contribution. And that first period, when they were collaborating very closely, was, I think, often people will say, the most productive period in Australian government after World War II. I think that's right.
Thanks, Barry. So, tears confirmed. Yes. Down here at the front. Thank you.
G'day, comrade. I want to make a passing remark and then ask for your opinion on a couple of things. The passing remark, as a sort of encouragement to those here, is the example from English history, from 18th century, of Old Pa. I mean, his name's still around as a commercial brand on something or other. Yep. He lived to be 152. He was put in the stocks for getting a young woman pregnant at the age of 105. So I just put that to the side, but I want to make a couple of things. One, you mentioned Descartes. Now, that's the bloke who first came up with the idea of public transport, and it was rubbished in Paris at the time. Yeah. But I want to ask two other things, your opinion on this. First, classical economics is based upon a fallacy, and that is that the resources of the earth are inexhaustible. I'd like your opinion on that. And the second thing, what is it about the education system in this country that after 10 or even 12 years in our schools, people can come out the other end and they're still influenced by commercial advertising?
I think that there is obviously good grounds for criticising classical economics, because there is that assumption that you can keep on consuming and consuming. And that's why when you think of what the projection is for, that they're now revising what the projections for maximum global population are, we're now thinking about 12 billion or perhaps even a little higher than 12 billion as being the peak. And then, because so many people will be living beyond the fertility period in life, then your birth rate's going to decline, simply because such a high proportion of people are incapable of doing it or having it done to them. And the other thing is that the assumption always was that the levels of consumption would remain high for countries like Australia and Europe and the United States and North America generally, but, well, the rest of the world wouldn't be consuming at anything like that rate. And as it is now, I mean, people are now assuming that you'd really have the resources of about 3.5 Earths in order to maintain, if the current projection of consumption continues, then, you know, you'd have to go on a very, very... We simply can't do it. So that's a problem. I am troubled about the education system, and I've written, again, quite a lot about that. I mean, it would seem... I mean, if you look at the figures, this is by far the best educated cohort in our history. If I ask people how many graduates they think there are, they always get the figure wrong, so I'll just toss it out to you. There are 4.5 million graduates living in Australia at the moment. 4.5 million. There are more than 1 million students, undergraduate and postgraduate and so on, in our universities as we speak. So the figures are really very high. Now, that ought to mean that the level of public debate is at unprecedented levels. Well, it isn't.
No.
It isn't. I mean, the level of public debate is simply appalling, because more and more people are simply pursuing the world of the personal and the immediate and the short term. And that's a great tragedy.
And the measurable.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
We all know how to measure things. But, yeah, I think the lack of critical thinking that you're referring to is a huge problem in our education system.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Do you have any other questions? Yes. Could we have the mic at the front? Thanks.
My name's Ian Clark.
That's right. We'll go here. We'll come back to you in a sec. Yes, sorry.
Barry, my name's Ian Clark. I had the privilege of being a student in the late 50s at Dandenong High School. And when I was there, I was introduced to the world of Lorenzo the Magnificent and Machiavelli, and I had my first Florence syndrome experience at the age of 15 at the Dandenong Theatre, and the Pearl Fishers was on, and In the Depths of the Temple came, and I felt those chills down my spine. So you've opened for me the world of ideas, of music, and of art, and of thinking. Going back to education, And you did that largely at lunchtimes and extracurricular stuff with slideshows and just opening people's minds.
Yeah.
With our reductionist thinking in education these days, and people like Christopher Pyne with his terrible ideology, what hope do we have in the education of young minds?
Well, this is something that I do agonise about a lot, and it's striking you mention about that Dandenong High experience, because I'm struck by how many people still keep in touch with me from that period, because they say I hadn't known about so and so, and that was all really very worthwhile. And I suppose what I'm concerned about, and I've got to choose my words carefully, because my office is actually in the Graduate School of Education at the University of Melbourne, so I've got to be very, very discreet about what I say.
No, you don't.
Well, no, but I can see that very often, you will talk to people, you'll see students who are teaching literature, we'll say, and we say, well, what are you reading lately? And they say, oh, I haven't got time to read. I'm so busy. I've got so much administrative work.
Oh, it's true.
I think, well, what was the last theatre you went to? You say, oh, well, haven't really been for a while.
There is no time to think in academia.
And that's the problem. It's not as if I can see that what made me a successful teacher, if I may be so bold, at that period, was that I had that degree of excitement about certain elements, and I was able to convey it, and it stuck. I remember years ago, it was funny, I was at a, there was an international conference over in Venice, and it was one of those weird things where I was the leader of the Australian delegation, and believe it or not, E.G. Whitlam was my deputy. Could you imagine?
How did he cope with that? But,
oh no, he's very good. He's very good. But somebody representing the ILO was somebody called Ross Fotheringham, who had been at Dandenong High, and Ross pulled me aside and said, "Look, I can't tell you." So I don't want to say this when the others are around, but he said, "I can't tell you how much it means to me to be here in Venice with you, because you used to talk about Titian and you used to talk about the other great." And he said, "It's so exciting to be here and have that synergy in Venice." So, yes,
the rewards of teaching can be there.
But the problem is, I can see that with so many of my colleagues. Colleagues as well, they're flat out. Some of them are doing second jobs. Some of them are really struggling, and they're absolutely struggling to keep up. And so the result is that and when I'll mention some new book or some new idea, there might be just a frisson of irritation where they say, "Look, I haven't got time to be."
That's true.
"It's all right for you. You're 82. You can do it too."
Yeah, that's right. Or has the movie come out yet? I'll wait for that.
Yeah.
we'll take one more question. Yes, thanks.
Thank you. Barry, I'm interested in just your view. You said that you had assisted a number of friends who were approaching death and that fourth age. I have a 94-year-old father who has a number of health issues. He has dementia, he's got prostate cancer. And I've now discovered, somewhat to my horror, my family is in New Zealand, that they're treating him with hormone drugs for the prostate cancer at age 94. And this is obviously beginning to have some quite dreadful side effects. He's at a stage, because he has got early stage dementia, where I don't really think he's necessarily asking the right questions or getting a full picture of side effects given to him by the medicos. And I guess my question, you know, either personally or philosophically to you, is this issue about over-medicating people and just trying to keep them alive. And I'm actually going over there in about 10 days and I'm going to have a discussion with him. And I'd just be interested in your view on that, where someone gets to the point that they are perhaps a bit confused. He's of that generation where he believes that the medicos are God. And I think people of my generation are less inclined to do that. I'd just like your view.
Look, I'm a bit reluctant to weigh into that issue, because it's an area where, I obviously have deep feelings about it and I've thought about it a lot, but I wouldn't pretend, it'd be foolish of me to claim any kind of expertise. All I can say is I happen to be a member of a lunch group that we meet every month, and most of the people there are very experienced medical people, researchers and so on. And what you're talking about is precisely the issue that they talk about a lot. If they were here today up here on the stage with Jill and me, they could give a much more profound, much more satisfactory answer than the one I have. I mean, I've heard them express their concern, but I don't want to get into that area, because it would be foolish of me to appear to claiming it, the kind of expertise that you need.
Do you have a personal opinion?
I think my personal opinion I don't think my personal opinion is going to be helpful. I think you've got to talk to people who are much better qualified than me and get their qualified opinion. I could come out with an opinion and it's a completely unqualified, highly personal, and I'm not sure that it's referable to anyone else.
Okay. It's midday, so we're going to wind this up. Thank you for your questions and for coming along. And Barry, thank you so much for being here with us. Thank you.